we shouldn't have a community that has no law enforcement, because when things go bad, bad things happen to kids.
A federal task force looks at the high rates of violence Alaska Native kids are exposed to. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, November 18th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, state employees complain about air quality at an office in Juneau.
Our employees were complaining for quite a while about headaches and other physical symptoms.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to having conversations that help businesses and individuals succeed financially, because an open dialogue can open doors. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
And by
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977.
American Indian and Alaska Native children see so much violence in their homes and communities that they suffer post-traumatic stress disorder at triple the rate of the general population, akin to veterans returning from Iraq and Afghanistan. That's one of the starting points of a new federal task force report on Indigenous children and their exposure to violence. APRN's Liz Ruskin reports on the panel's presentation today to the Department of Justice.
High-level administrators from Justice, Interior, and other federal departments attended the meeting in downtown Washington. If any of them needed convincing Indigenous children endure too many traumas, it wasn't BIA head Kevin Washburn, a Chickasaw member.
When I was growing up in Oklahoma, I had an uncle in prison for a drug offense. I had another uncle who basically drank himself to death. I had a cousin die of a drug overdose, and I had a cousin who was murdered. And so, that's not an unusual story for anyone who's spent significant time in Indian country.
The 11-member task force, chartered more than a year ago to advise the U.S. Attorney General, convened hearings around the country, including sessions in Anchorage and Bethel. They heard from people who were raised amid violence and who had seen the failures of state foster care and juvenile detention. Panel Chairman Byron Dorgan, a former senator from North Dakota, says he was moved by an Alaskan survivor who said he was constantly told as a child he was nobody.
It takes a kind of a constitution with some strength to listen to some of the stories, because it breaks your heart, and yet it also creates a steely resolve to try to decide, I must do something about this.
The report makes dozens of recommendations, but most fall into two categories: empower tribes and provide more secure funding for tribal programs and services. Dorgan says Congress has to treat funding for Indian child health and safety as mandatory spending.
When you have trust responsibilities and you've signed treaties, don't tell me it's discretionary about whether you fund programs that help children. It is not discretionary.
Valerie Davidson, the only Alaskan on the task force, says she was struck by what one witness said about the effort and uncertainty that now surrounds the funding for many vital tribal programs.
We compete for grants, and we put our hearts and our souls into that grant application process, and we really hope that we win. But we know that if we win, 555 other tribes lose. And what are we going to do about their children?
The report devotes a chapter to Alaska. It says that while the problem of children exposed to violence is severe in all American Indian communities, it's systemically worse in Alaska. It cites the higher rate of violent crime, remoteness, and the lack of respect for tribal sovereignty. The report incorporates the findings last year of the Indian Law and Order Commission, including its call to recognize broad Indian country jurisdiction in Alaska. Davidson calls it disgraceful that Alaska Native people don't have the protections under tribal law that other American Indian people are entitled to.
You know, let's be honest about Alaska. The Alaska exemptions about jurisdiction and federal law are really Alaska punishments, and they are especially harmful for our children, and that needs to stop.
The state of Alaska has defended those exemptions in the past, saying Congress, with the concurrence of the Alaska Federation of Natives, rejected the reservation concept when it passed the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act in 1971. The state, though, says it is cooperating with Alaska tribes to improve law enforcement in the villages. Davidson says the state needs to make village safety a higher priority.
We shouldn't have a community that has no law enforcement, because when things go bad, bad things happen to kids.
The report also says the federal and state governments should empower tribes to manage their own subsistence hunting and fishing. Davidson says that may sound out of place in a report like this, but she says subsistence is vital to Alaska Native families.
And we know that when families have pressure, when they can't feed themselves, we know that's when we see increases in violence.
She says the rates of violence against children drop during the summer when families are busy fishing, hunting, and picking berries. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
The Bureau of Ocean Energy Management is in the process of drafting an environmental impact statement on a proposed Cook Inlet oil and gas lease sale. It could open up the federally managed waters of Cook Inlet to oil and gas exploration. BOEM held a series of public scoping meetings on the Kenai Peninsula last week. KBBI's Quinton Chandler attended the meeting in Homer and has this story.
Most of the crowd that came out to Homer Middle School Thursday night seemed decidedly against the very idea of a lease sale. In fact, several asked point blank why the BOEM representatives even bothered to make the trip, given some Homer residents' past stance on oil and gas exploration in the inlet. Mike O'Mara has lived near Kachemak Bay since 1976.
Well, I've gone through this process many times. Then Minerals Management was selling a lease sale. Comments that were made by people didn't appear to be taken seriously. The decision to move ahead was pretty much a foregone conclusion with previous sales.
BOEM representatives say there have been 13 wells drilled in Cook Inlet's federally owned waters in the past 20 years, but currently there are none left. Frank Mullen says it should stay that way. His greatest concern is the risk of an oil spill.
I know that those of us who have been here for many years and have observed all the various, you know, lease sales and proposals are pretty disappointed that we're being faced yet again with the prospect of having to go to work to convince an agency that this is a bad idea.
Mullen recalls past offshore drilling accidents elsewhere that proved cleaning up oil in these particular waters would be impossible.
Anytime the wind blows more than 10 or 15 knots, the booms and the skimmers and all the equipment that is currently at hand becomes useless.
The BOEM representatives heard all of these concerns 10 times over, and Dr. James Kendall, the director of BOEM's Anchorage office, basically said, if you don't want a sale, put it in writing.
Okay, that's what we want to hear. We are here because the law says we have to be here. The thing is, we have new decision makers. Some of them are brand new. They don't know the process. They're learning the process. Yes, I understand it's a burden. But by the same token, the law says we have to do it. So we can take your comments back to a whole group of new decision makers and say, look, this is what people are saying.
A number of the attendees made it clear that wasn't the answer they were looking for. But people seemed to understand putting their opinions to paper was their best shot at being heard. More than a few were diligently taking down notes and comments throughout the meeting. O'Mara shrugs it off. In Homer, I'm Quinton Chandler.
A heavy lift ship dropped anchor in Kachemak Bay last Tuesday. The Zhenhua is making preparations to tow offshore drilling rig Endeavor Spirit of Independence to South Africa. The rig has been parked in storage in Port Graham since last winter. Homer Harbor Master Brian Hawkins says the Zhenhua will begin loading the Endeavor and could head to sea as soon as tomorrow.
There's a lot of components that have to be completed before they can load it. A lot of work on the ship, getting the deck prepared, but if everything goes as planned and the weather cooperates, then they'll bring it in.
The Endeavor was leased by Buccaneer Energy before the company filed for bankruptcy. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, does this sound like a museum?
We are in the fourth floor Chugach Gallery. And it is very loud because we have a rock band, the Sweeteners, playing up here.
The Anchorage Museum works to draw a younger crowd. That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Nana Regional Corporation and Tech Alaska, celebrating 25 years of resource development and partnership at the Red Dog Mine. And by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
The state has released a long in the works plan for improving Fairbanks air quality. The community regularly falls short of federal fine particulate pollution standards in the winter, but many residents rely on wood burning for heat. There's opposition to any sort of burn ban. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, that's not part of the plan.
The Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation State Implementation Plan, or SIP, outlines measures to reduce fine particulate pollution and bring Fairbanks air quality in line with federal standards over the next 5 years. Cindy Heil with the DEC Division of Air Quality says stoves and other wood and coal-burning devices will continue to be allowed even when air quality is poor.
You can continue to use those however you need to use them correctly, and how it will be you'll be able to tell if someone is using them incorrectly is through their visible emissions.
The state plan includes smoke opacity standards, which get tougher as air quality conditions worsen.
If the air quality is poor, if you have an air quality advisory, then you need to have a visible emissions of 50%. You have to meet that. If the air quality begins to deteriorate or get worse and that concentrations are continuing to rise, then the opacity levels will begin to drop and get more stringent. So there's a 40%, there's a 30%, and there's a 20%.
Heil says violators identified by public complaints whose emissions are found to be out of compliance will receive advice on clean burning and options for upgrading their stove or boiler. Violators who fail to take corrective action can be taken to court. Heil says tightened emission standards reflect public input during the regulatory development process.
People who are doing it correctly didn't want to have their wood stoves, you know, or the perception of their wood stoves going away. They wanted to be able to continue to use their wood stoves, and they wanted more focus on those who weren't using good wood burning practices.
Other measures in the plan include a dry wood requirement, an emissions standard for new stoves and boilers, and a requirement that non-compliant units be changed out of homes prior to the sale of a property. The plan does not demonstrate an ability to meet a federal 2015 attainment deadline, but Heil stresses it does lay out a path for progress toward attainment in 2019. The state is taking feedback on the plan through December 19th, and several public meetings are scheduled. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Air quality testing shows high levels of carbon dioxide and dust in Juneau's Bill Ray Center, an office building the state is leasing for about 160 employees. For more than a month, the state has fielded complaints from employees about headaches and diesel fumes. KTOO's Lisa Fu has more.
Julie Benarski's desk is at the Bill Ray Center, but she hasn't been there for more than a week. Her supervisor gave her permission to work from home due to the air quality at the office. Bednarski is a research biologist for the Department of Fish and Game. In mid-October, she says she started smelling diesel exhaust fumes in the office.
One day it was pretty heavy and I was starting to feel sick.
First National Bank Alaska bought the Bill Ray Center from University of Alaska Southeast in September 2013. Since March, the state has been leasing it for $49,500 a month while the Douglas Island State Office Building is being renovated. Employees of Fish and Game and the Department of Corrections started moving into the Bill Ray Center last April. Sunny Haight is the administrative director of Fish and Game. She started hearing about air quality issues in September.
Our employees were complaining for quite a while about headaches and other physical symptoms and difficulty in their work environment.
Haight says complaints varied.
Sometimes they'd say it was fumes, and sometimes it smelled like there was something burnt. Sometimes they'd say it was a chemical smell.
Haight reached out to the State Department of Administration, which handles leasing and facilities. The state first contacted First National Bank September 15th about potential problems with the Bill Ray Center's heating, ventilation, and air conditioned system. It asked the bank to conduct an air quality test, which the bank didn't do. Sherry Gillen is the bank's communications senior vice president. She says the bank has responded in good faith.
When we
started getting the complaints, we engaged with various contractors to ensure that all the equipment in the building was operating at peak efficiency to ensure that all equipment was working. And those contractors reported they did not recognize any smells inside the building. Conducting an air quality survey was not off the table. We just hadn't arrived at that point.
The state hired environmental engineering firm Nortech to perform an air quality test in the building in mid-October. Haight says it cost around $8,000. Results came back November 5th. The Nortech report shows higher than normal levels of carbon dioxide associated with headaches, sleepiness, and stagnant, stale, stuffy air. Those levels could also lead to increased heart rate, slight nausea, poor concentration, and loss of attention. But they fall below what is legally acceptable. Again, Sunny Haight.
What has people concerned is the level that it's at is very close to unacceptable.
Results also show elevated levels of dust in a part of the Bilray Center. First National Bank is constructing a new branch in an adjacent lot. Forklifts, cranes, and other heavy machinery have been operating near the building's fresh air intake. The Nortech report indicates inadequate ventilation for the 160 employees. It recommends improving the old HVAC system. Department of Administration spokesman Andy Mills says the air quality test was done as quickly as possible.
Unfortunately, that was delayed by the owner of the building not acting faster, but the state does not want employees working in areas where they don't feel that they're most productive or that there may be any associated health concerns on the employee's part.
Mills says to speed things up, the state requested Nortech skip its normal routine of interviewing employees in the building. On November 10th, the state sent a letter to First National Bank stating it was out of compliance with the lease. The state requested a written plan of action by November 14th. The bank's reply reached the state on the 17th. Gillen says the bank has hired its own consultant, Modern Mechanical, to evaluate the Bilray Center this week and doesn't plan to act until reviewing the consultant's work. In the meantime, the state has offered space at the downtown state office building to Bilray Center employees affected by the air quality. The state plans to move employees back into the Douglas Island building this summer. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
Transboundary mine opponents are trying a new tactic in their opposition to a project northwest of Ketchikan. They're telling investors and anyone else who will listen that the KSM mine is a bad place to put their money. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
The group Salmon Beyond Borders just released a study detailing its opposition to the Kerr Sulphurets Mitchell, or KSM, mine. It's a copper, gold, and silver deposit upstream of two rivers that enter the ocean within about 50 miles of Ketchikan. The report claims the mine is too remote, too expensive, and too dangerous to the environment.
We're trying to make sure people understand the risks and uncertainty of KSM.
Chris Zimmer works with Salmon Beyond Borders, a coalition of environmental, tribal, and fisheries organizations.
The company has put out a very rosy prospectus and environmental assessment and is probably going to be start looking for major investors and development money here if they haven't started that already. And part of our task here is to make sure that observers and folks interested in the KSM project understand the risk.
We're confident that the risks are actually decreasing, not increasing.
Brent Murphy is Vice President for Environmental Affairs for Seabridge Gold. That's the KSM Prospects parent corporation. He says Seabridge won't build or operate the proposed $5.3 billion mine on its own, and it's already talking to investors.
We have confidentiality agreements with major mining companies, and there's discussions are ongoing. So, we have people that are going through our files.
The Salmon Beyond Borders report mostly repeats earlier statements made by mine opponents, but it cites more sources and includes more details, and its impact could be different. That's because word about the report was distributed on MarketWired, a business-oriented public relations site. Zimmer says it targets government officials and the general public, but he hopes it will also be read by potential investors.
People need to take a second look at this thing and hopefully look at information not just from the company.
Among his group's claims, KSM is not economically feasible.
You know, several analysts have looked at this and said, boy, this price of gold needs to be quite a bit higher to make a project like this economical, given the low grade of the ore and the overall expense here.
KSM's Murphy says that's not the case. He says the numbers are getting better, and continued drilling has found more and better deposits at two of its four proposed mining sites.
We've extended the deep Kerr to both the north and south, and we've also identified a higher grade core at depth with, associated with the iron cap.
The British Columbia government okayed KSM's environmental protection plan last summer. The next major step is similar approval from Canada's federal government. This is Ed Schoenfeld reporting in Juneau.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Crowley. Celebrating 60 years in Alaska, Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com. Public Employees Local 71 asks you to slow down in construction zones while they work to keep roads safe. Public Employees Local 71, working hard for Alaska. Alaska laborers and the Alaska Department of Transportation and Public Facilities also know the importance of safe driving in construction zones. This message sponsored by Public Employees Local 71.
The Kuskokwim 300 Sled Dog Race is now a 12-dog event. The race committee decided this fall to lower the dog limit from 14 to 12. KYUK's Ben Matheson has more.
Zach Fansler, the K300 race manager, says a driving idea behind the change was to encourage more local mushing teams to run the full 300.
But some of our teams that are kind of mid-sized kennels that maybe have participated in the K300 in the past or have looked to do those kinds of things don't always have 14 dogs that are ready to go, or maybe they only have 11 or so, and might feel discouraged and not participate in the 300 at that higher level.
Many larger teams, however, use the K300 to test out dogs in a race scenario prior to the March Iditarod.
It does kind of give them two less dogs to look at. And that was something that I think weighed very heavily on the minds of the board when they were making this decision. The kind of reasoning behind this, or the push behind this, was that it actually came up at last year's Mushers meeting.
The YK Delta's muddy trails may not be race ready now, but with a higher purse and no entry fees, Fansler says he's seen a lot of interest from big-time mushers like Didi Jonro, the Boozers, and Yor Olsom.
We've heard from Brent Sass and from Hugh Neff. We've heard from Lance Mackey. Right now, we believe that we could have a field larger than we've seen since the early 90s, late 80s.
Fansler expects local mushers to be at the starting line, but he doesn't have the official word yet from nine-time champion Jeff King. The race keeps the rest rules from 2014, which allow for 6 hours of flexible rest time. Queetluck will be the first official checkpoint, although mushers are not required to sign in or out. The YK Delta racing season kicks off December 20th with the Holiday Classic, a 40-mile race out of Bethel. The season continues a week later with the 100-mile challenge. The 2015 Kuskokwim 300 begins January 16th. In Bethel, I'm Ben Matheson.
As cultural institutions across the country struggle to stay relevant in a changing financial landscape, many are testing new ways to raise funds and expand membership. As KSKA's Zechariah Hughes reports, the Anchorage Museum is trying to recruit the next wave of museum buffs in some unconventional ways.
In a brightly lit gallery, Kim Klecker is standing in front of a giant framed painting of Denali. She's not just enjoying the picture, she's about to marry it.
Do you, Kim, take this painting to love it, comfort it, honor it, and keep it in health and in sickness, forsaking all others, be faithful to it as long as you shall exist?
I do.
Rayette Sterling presided over Klecker's ceremony and about 20 others on Friday for the museum's second annual Lights Out event. Sterling was beaming, hopeful that faux marriages to sculptures and canvases could turn partygoers into card-carrying museum members.
The art is so important, and the idea that people can actually kind of have a silly symbol of something they love and to bring that art kind of into their heart and into their lives is just sort of special and fun.
That was certainly true for Klecker, the bride, who renewed her museum membership that night, shortly before exchanging vows with a 13-foot Sidney Lawrence landscape. The piece is her favorite in the museum's permanent collection.
It's not often that you see canvases of this size, and so you're just drawn into the picture. It's like you're part of it rather than observing art. And because I'm a traditionalist at heart, and in the Anchorage Museum, it doesn't get any more traditional than Sidney Lawrence.
And Klecker is closer to the museum's traditional target for fundraising. She has a stable career, disposable income, and is enthusiastic about familiar models of fine arts, like oil-on-canvas landscapes in a curated gallery. By contrast, 20-something Tamara Cornfield is closer to who the Lights Out event aims to pull in.
Yeah, it seems like kind of a widespread. There's older people, but there's also all the way down to 21, which I wouldn't normally think would want to go to the museum on a Friday night. But everyone's here, and there's, you know, dancing upstairs, a band, and then this DJ is killing it.
Cornfield is on a balcony above the dance floor, where a photo booth is set up in between art installations. Tickets for Lights Out were $30 at the door, but Cornfield says the open access to galleries, music, and such an excited crowd made the price worth it.
This is really fun, so I would pay to come back, and I'd bring friends.
That's exactly what Lindsay Garrett wants to hear. She works on visitor engagement for the museum and came up with a lot of the ideas spread across all four floors of the building.
Can you do your best to just tell me where we are and why it's so loud?
We are in the fourth floor Chugach Gallery, and it is very loud because we have a rock band, the Sweeteners, playing up here.
Rock bands, DJs, and novelty weddings are a far cry from the formal affairs people think of when it comes to museum fundraising parties, if they think of parties at all. And Garrett says that's what she's going for.
Well, I think one of the things that we're really hoping to do is find different ways to engage people that might not necessarily think of themselves as museum people. And I think we're trying to change people's ideas of what goes on here.
That doesn't mean the Anchorage Museum can afford or has an interest in moving away from the wealthy individual and corporate donations that make up the lion's share of its funding base. But testing unconventional programming, like nimble pop-up exhibits and late-night parties that bring new patrons into the galleries, are an effort to keep the museum relevant and truly contemporary. Gain that support, Garrett says, and dollars will follow. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Quentin Chandler in Homer, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Lisa Fu and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Ben Matheson in Bethel, and Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage. APRN's Liz Ruskin reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
Salmon are all around us. They're in our rivers and our freezers. They fuel our economies and keep Alaskans connected to our traditions, our families, and our friends. The Salmon Project celebrates all the ways salmon are interwoven with our Alaskan lives. Learn more about the project and find out how you can be involved at salmonproject.org or find them on Facebook. Salmon, it runs deep in all Alaskans. This message sponsored by the Salmon Project. Alaska Native elders are 5 times more likely to be injured in a fall, but there are simple ways for elders to reduce fall-related injuries. Get an eye exam every year. Stay informed about medications that can cause dizziness. Exercise regularly to increase strength and balance, and keep your home clutter-free. This message sponsored by the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium.
From resource issues to recreational activities, APRN brings you the up-to-date information you need for life in Alaska.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.